Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Back when disco was huge, everybody boogied. The country caught Saturday Night Fever. A few ran screaming, many more danced. Behind the glitter and polyester, my guest today says, disco blew open American culture. This hour on Point, the liberation in disco. You can join the conversation this hour. Were you there? Have you listened back? Are you prepared to hear the disco beat as the pulse of liberating change for gays, African Americans, women? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we will be joined by five-time Grammy Award-winning artist Donna Summer, the queen of disco herself. But joining me first now from Culver City, California, is Alice Eccles, professor of American Studies and History at Rutgers University. She was a disco DJ herself in her younger days in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Her new book is Hot Stuff, Disco and the Remaking of American Culture. Alice Eccles, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for having me on your show.
I think we'd better plunge pretty quickly into the meat of your argument. The New York Times says you have few peers among music sociologists. New York Newsday calls your book exhilarating. But a lot of people are going to hear that beat, and maybe they'll be inspired. But, you know, you yourself note that it's widely considered mindless, repetitive, formulaic, and banal. So what merits the book, Alice?
Well, just listen to that wonderful song with Donna Summer. I mean, that's just a wonderful, wonderful song. But to sort of get to the broad outlines of the argument that I make in Hot Stuff, I mean, I think so often we tend to think of the 1970s as the kind of anti-60s. You know, this was the moment where the great we-ness of the 60s gave way to the horrible me-ness of the 1970s. And yet what I would argue and what I do argue in this book is that there were really significant changes happening in the 1970s. Think about what happens to nightlife. Nightlife becomes integrated in American culture in a way in which it never really has been before.
You mean racially integrated?
Racially, yeah. Absolutely. Very, very key. I mean, you know, you had places like the Fillmore Ballroom that plays psychedelic rock, but for the most part, you know, there were exceptions, but those were largely white venues. And with disco, it brought together all kinds of different people. For gay men, it represented that moment when they really go visible in American culture. It's where they become a part of American culture in a way that they hadn't before. I mean, it's certainly true that gay men had played important roles, certainly in Hollywood, and certainly, I mean, I would say especially in the theater and in the movies, but most people didn't really know about that. And with disco, they become much more visible, and I would say they really begin to experience themselves a different kind of nightlife. Gay bars before disco had been places where, you know, they were very, very apt to be raided by the police. They were places of harassment. Mm-hmm. It was not at all uncommon for gay men to be unable to actually dance with one another on the dance floor. There had to be a dance, you know, a kind of dance floor beard in the form of a woman.
Or if they did, the police might show up quickly. We'll look at that.
Absolutely.
Give us the women's piece, and then we'll take it from the top with African Americans.
Sure.
But what did disco do for women besides put them in funny shoes?
Well, it put them in fun shoes, but it also put them on the dance floor. And certainly it's the case, I think, that, you know, women have traditionally been more eager to get on the dance floor than men, which may account for some of the resistance on the part of male rockers to disco. But it's also true that disco really really foregrounded female desire in a way that hadn't been true in rock music. I mean, yes, Janis Joplin, whom I've also written about, certainly gave voice to women's desires, but there was always a kind of angst to her music. And with disco, it was really this kind of delirious expression of the wonderfulness of female desire. And for me, this was, given voice, I think most famously by Donna Summer in Love to Love You, Baby, that I think it was 17-minute cut.
Where she's so way really, out there in the Eros zone, and there's
exactly.
No doubt whatsoever about it. We'll talk to Donna Summer herself, a disco queen, before we get out of this hour. But I want to go back to your point on the race front. And it was partly, as you write, Alice, in Hot Stuff, it was partly integration, racial integration on the dance floor. But it was also about, in a way, as you describe it, a kind of liberation of African-American artists to go into a different mode. Here's a little, this is not disco, this is the other. We're going to hear James Brown, get up off of that thing. Tell us what to look for, listen for here, Alice, before we go to Barry White and disco.
Get up well, off of that thing, and shake the groove, feel better. Get up off of that thing, and try to release that pressure. Get up off.
Sorry, Alice, James Brown would not be constrained there.
He never could be. Well, this is a song in which, James Brown is really trying to claim back the dance floor for himself. You know, he had been the king of the dance floor until disco shoved him aside. And, what he's singing about here is he's trying to get dancers to release the pressure and to give up to the funk. And to basically move away from music, disco, that he thought really tamped down, ratcheted down the funkiness in black popular music. And so this is a very raw, funky cut. And it's meant, again, to be this kind of reassertion of kind of 60s soul style. I mean, modified somewhat for disco dance floors. It's a very powerful cut. In the course of this cut, one of the members of his band, one of the JBs, shouts out in a very derisive way something about Barry White Boy. And that's meant to be a slam of Barry White, obviously. But for James Brown and for some partisans of 60s soul, I mean, disco really took black music, in their view, to a place which was soulless and schmaltzy, rather than raw and spontaneous.
And but kind I think of white by some African-American ears.
Yeah. I mean, I think Nelson George called it beige music.
Let's hear some of that. Here's Barry White's Love's theme, with James Brown is complaining about there, in effect.
Yeah.
Okay, we all know it. And gritty, this is not. No wonder James Brown was going out of his mind about this. But you describe it in another's way as a kind of liberation, even for black musicians.
Absolutely. I mean, if you really go back and listen to the music and listen also to what black musicians and producers who were involved in disco were saying about it, what you hear are people saying, listen, we are claiming the mantle of sophistication here. We are refusing this imperative that black music always sound raw and gritty in the style of James Brown. And the group that really, really does this very consciously actually is a group called Chic, most famous for La Freak, which I think you're going to be playing
we
later.
Will. Mm-hmm.
And they're very much about reversing the traffic. I mean, think about popular music. Where would rock have ever been without R&B? There is this long tradition in American popular music of white musicians being influenced by black. When black musicians begin to borrow some of the conventions, and in this case some of the kind of elements of the symphonic to black music, it's seen as selling out, it's seen as beige music, as whitening it up. And yet, again, if you read what they're saying about it, they feel a real liberation in being able to claim this mantle of sophistication.
You were there as a disco DJ yourself, Ann Arbor,
yes,
during the height of the disco era. Was that really an integrated scene? I mean, how far did this racial integration go? Ann Arbor?
Well, Ann Arbor is this interesting university town, and I DJed at a gay bar called the Rubaiyat, and the Rubaiyat was on most nights a largely white gay male club. On the nights that I DJed, because I put a lot of funk into the mix, it attracted a wider variety of people, and indeed it was an integrated dance floor. Now, let me just say that got me into trouble because there were gay men there who really, really preferred a dance space that was more theirs, a space of, a space that included fewer women and I think in this instance, fewer African Americans who were heterosexual. And as I write in the book, I mean, I ended up getting fired because I refused to not play funk. And I never really knew, to tell you the truth, if the reason I was fired was because they felt threatened by heterosexual men, which is what they told me, or if it was just really out-and-out racism. I mean, I just never really knew. But it certainly was the case that on the nights that I DJed, it was very much an integrated dance floor. And people really, I mean, it was quite wonderful seeing the kind of breaking down of those racial barriers.
Here we are all these years later, and here at the London Times saying it's camp, it's glamorous, and it's back, disco. We'll look at what's back, we'll look at what changed back in the disco era, and we will talk with Donna Summer, disco queen herself, when we return. You can join us. Did disco really liberate American gays, blacks, women? Alice Eccles' book is Hot Stuff. We're at 1-800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about disco and what it meant. Here's YMCA 1978.
There's no need to feel down. I said, young man, pick yourself off the ground. I said, young man, 'cause you're in a new town. There's no need to be unhappy, young man. There's a place you can go. I said, young man, when you're short on your dough, you can stay there. And I'm sure you will find many ways to have a good time. It's fun to stay at the YMCA. It's fun to stay at the YMCA.
The Village People, 1978. Alice Eccles is with us, professor of American Studies and History at Rutgers. Her big new book is Hot Stuff, Disco and the Remaking of American Culture. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Did disco really liberate American gays, blacks, women? Is that what people were thinking under the glitter ball? Was that you in the unbuttoned polyester shirt doing the boogie-oogie-oogie? Were you gay in 1978 and loving it? Did disco set you free? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Alice Eccles joins us from Culver City, California. Let's get a caller right here. Kathy, Charlotte, North Carolina. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This
Hi.
Is a great subject, especially for Friday. I really appreciate it. We need some rhythm back on the airwaves. I grew up in the era of disco, particularly towards the end of 76 throughout, and was able to fortunately get into clubs around Charlotte before, you know, we were not really integrated at the time, but because I was exposed to that and Soul Train and American Bandstand and, you know, groups like Casey and the Sunshine Band and, the Village People, they were integrated groups. So, you know, it just became a part of our accepting of, you know, the music and the people that we were able to enjoy listening to. And we need it back. We need some happy music. The alternative music we're listening to now is way too serious. the rap is way too, I can't go there. And it's a great topic.
We need disco back, Kathy. We've got it. And you may get it back. You may hear in this hour that it is back anyway. But thank you for your call. And let's get one more from your old DJ stomping grounds from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Matthew, you're on the air with Alice Eccles.
Hello. How are you guys doing?
We're great. What do you think?
Fine.
I'm thinking about how, I'm a master's in urban planning student, and disco also corresponded in a time in central cities in America when there wasn't very many families or wasn't a lot of middle-class white Americans living there. So it almost was this, like, reclaiming of a lot of minority groups to, like, claim the central city really as their own in a period of time when there was a lot of violence and it wasn't really a safe place. So disco was this really important cultural moment of minority groups really taking claim to a place that they had kind of been marginalized at the last, 40 to 50 years.
Minorities taking claims. You may be right, but Alice, help me understand. I mean, I was out of the country for a lot of that time, but I did get to some discos in the 70s. I saw a lot of white folks there.
Oh, yeah. Well, certainly. I mean, it is the case that there were a lot of white folks in discos. And there was, listen, discos, I mean, there was no monolithic disco scene. Instead, there were different disco scenes, but some were more racially integrated than others, that's for sure. But I think it is definitely the case that in some ways disco was the end point of Motown. I mean, think about Berry Gordy's dream. His dream was to make music that would be the sound of young America, right?
Yeah.
And this was going to be music in which, his artists, his African-American artists, were not going to be sitting at the back of the musical bus. They were going to be playing Vegas, right? They were going to be going, they were going to play on every station, not just soul stations. And in some ways, disco is really the culmination of that. Although I would say that it went beyond in its aspirations just young America. I mean, it wanted to conquer all of America. And in fact, I think when it conquers all of America, that's when it loses its cachet. It's when, as one of the people in my book says, it's when, your uncle out in Long Island is learning how to disco dance, right? It's like, forget it.
And now every uncle at every wedding, right, for all these decades. Here's a song that you describe, and an artist you describe as kind of a poster boy for gay disco. This is Sylvester, 1978, You Make Me Feel Mighty Real. There's Sylvester, 1978. Now, with this was not 1969 and the Stonewall Riots anymore, where, as you describe, police busting into a gay bar to make arrests. Instead, this had gone so mainstream that, I mean, it may have been a gay anthem, disco may have been a gay milieu, but I think an awful lot of Americans were out there dancing with very little thought of that or awareness that was also going on, Alice.
It's interesting. When the anti-disco campaign started up, when it really reached its culmination in around 78 or 79, one of the things that radio consultants found when they were interviewing listening groups and trying to figure out listening taste and listening patterns was that when they played them disco, they initially had relatively open minds to it, but there would be a couple of disco phobes, let's say, in these groups who would say, well, this is just music of gay men, although they would do it with different kinds of epithets, or, this is just music of black people. And in fact, the campaign against disco really played on the fact that it was gay music and it was black music. I would totally agree with you, Tom, that for the vast majority of Americans, the idea that disco was gay sort of, passed them completely by. But it didn't pass everybody by, that's for sure. And this was something that, again, those DJs who were really leading the kind of campaign against disco made quite a lot of.
But as you say, it meant a lot of liberation to be in public dancing for gays on the dance floor. And, gee, it was as mainstream as it could be for some really big years there. Here's a clip from the 1977 hit movie Saturday Night Fever, directed by John Badham. John Travolta starring here as Tony Manero, disco-strutting dancer who really kind of shifted social conventions about what macho might mean. It looked very different in this John Travolta. Here's Val Basoglu as his father criticizing John Travolta's character as he clears the dinner table, getting ready to go out for some disco.
What the hell are you doing?
I just feel like it, right?
Girls do that.
I got a raise today. How you like that?
Yeah. Why don't you say so during dinner? We could have used the conversation. Put them down. Come on. How much you get?
It's gonna be $4. It was $2.50, right? But he raised the raise when he found out I wasn't so disappointed.
$4?
Yeah.
You know, $4 buys today. Don't even buy $3.
I don't see nobody giving you a raise down on employment.
$4.
I knew you'd on it. Go on, just on it, right? A raise says like you're good, you know what I mean? You know how many times somebody told me I was good in my life? Two times. This raise today and dancing at the disco. You sure as never did.
Pugnacious John Travolta in Saturday Night Fever, and very soon he would be on the dance floor. And macho in a whole new way. Eric in Brookline, Massachusetts. Eric, you're on the air.
It's a great conversation you're having today. I was a disc jockey back in the late 70s in the disco area, working mostly college parties. And I want to say it was such great, happy music. I used to see crowds that were black and white, gay and straight, coming together and just having a good time dancing. I was part of an organization called Studio Guam that used to be a disco without walls. We'd show up in abandoned storefronts or the top floor of the UMass Library in Amherst with music and attract a crowd and have a party. And it was... that music could do it. I think it's held up really well over time.
Oh, that's so interesting. And it really gets to the sort of connection also, I would argue, between disco and rap, which are often seen as simply antagonists. But really, rap grows out of, and those kinds of street parties, you know, started by DJs like Kool Herc in New York City. I mean, it really grows out of disco culture.
Eric, thanks for your call. We've talked about some of the influence in African-American culture, certainly a kind of liberation for gays on the disco dance floor. There was, Alice Eccles writes in Hot Stuff, a liberation for women as well. Nobody sang that any more explicitly than Donna Summer. She is going to join us in just a moment. Here she is, 1979, Bad Girls. Donna Summer, 1979. Here's a web comment from our website. It says, disco gave voice to many female rockers. I don't think you'd see Blondie or the Blackhearts without Donna Summer and others bridging the gap between them and the Ronettes. Donna Summer herself joins us right now from Florida, 5-time Grammy Award-winning Queen of Disco. Donna Summer, it's just great to have you here. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
It's just great to have you. Alice Eccles says you were leading a liberation movement. Did it feel that way at the time, Donna?
Well, I'm not sure that I realized it at the time. I mean, I was just trying to be free myself and shake myself free at the time. I was in Hair and all of those several different musicals of that nature of that, you know, prior to that. And I just felt like I wanted to cross boundaries. That has always been my thing, is to cross the boundaries, to unite things, to be a bridge, you know, a compass, and to be a bridge. And so I think that, for me, that was more my goal. And if in that process people got liberated, I think that's great.
And when you were out there singing Love to Love You Baby with 18 minutes of Ooh La La, were you thinking, I'm going to help American women loosen up and enjoy their libidos, here we go?
No, I was thinking my father's going to kill me. My father is going to kill me.
You grew up sort of in our backyard here in Boston's Mission Hill and around, and very much in the kind of gospel tradition. Did your family come after you for what you were doing on stage? It was sure working with the audience.
Well, I mean, I think that my parents I was over 21 at the time, so yeah. There was not a lot that they could do. I think they weren't happy initially with this particular song, Love to Love You Baby.
Mm-hmm.
They were happy with the finances, but they weren't happy with the song. And I think that they felt that it wasn't displaying my vocal abilities. And after being in the theater and doing a lot of different things, they couldn't figure out why that would be the song I would become successful with. But that's the one it was.
There it was. And it was just as big as could be. Alice Eccles, you've written so wonderfully on this. What did Donna Summer mean to disco? What did she mean to the liberation kind of dynamic you're writing about, Alice?
Listen, I don't think anyone, and it's so wonderful to have you on this show. Let me just say that.
Sure is.
I don't think any female vocalist really gave voice to women's sexual desires quite as well as Donna Summer. And I think many, many, many people would agree with me on that. I believe I even ran across a quote from Emmylou Harris to that effect. Somebody working in a very different genre. But I think really, I mean, you listen to your music, you listen to Hot Stuff, you know, you listen to Bad Girls, and there's just this kind of, I don't know quite how to describe it, but this sort of embracing of your own pleasure, however uncomfortable you may have been, and as I understand it, you were in that recording studio when you did Love to Love You Baby, that really comes across, that kind of exuberance comes across in the recordings. And one of the things that I love about Bad Girls is that you sing about it in a way that suggests that, as you say, that you and the bad girls are just the same.
Yeah.
And there's a way in which, yeah, you have the sense, at least I do when I listen to it, that you know something about the experience of being made into a commodity,
mm-hmm.
and of being in a certain way.
I think that the point that I was making is that all women in this modern world, as we excel and as we go further, that we're selling ourselves on
yes.
whichever level that is. It could be emotionally, physically. I mean, we sell parts of ourselves to get to the dream, to hold the dream, to have the prize. And they may be selling their bodies. They may be on the first rung of it all. But the fact is that we're not that different.
Donna, Alice says, you know, you gave voice to women's sexual desire. How do you look back on that now? Do you feel like you were... You know, you might have not have thought it at a time, but you look back on yourself as the great liberator. Are you glad, or you
well,
think it's
I mean,
a good thing that happened?
Said that. People have said that, but I think the thing that for me, I had a lot of traumas in my childhood, as most people have,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think that I'm that different from anyone else.
Right.
So I'm not saying that as a you know,
mm-hmm.
Right. I had this problem. Yeah, I had plenty. I don't even want to discuss them. But the point is that I think that what I was trying to get to in those songs, especially Love to Love You Baby, was this. Getting back to the femininity of women, because we've become so emasculated by trying to be, you know, liberated, that sometimes I think we've forgotten the essence of who we are. We have breasts. We can feed and sustain
mm-hmm.
life. So
mm-hmm.
in that context, I was trying to say, no, come back. You know, this is who we are. We can have those things. All we have to do is use what we got, you know,
yep.
and... That's, I think, the point that I was making.
And what about as an African-American artist? Was it a liberating genre for you? Did you feel trapped ultimately? Did it feel like you were doing something new, breaking racial boundaries?
Well, I think maybe not with that particular song. I think that song was kind of a general song, but I think in every song that I did along the way, there were boundaries that I was trying very hard to surpass at the point, you know, where they would separate this music from that music. I was saying, I make music, period. Whatever it is, calibrate the song, you know, categorize the song, but don't categorize me because I'm going to fool you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that that was the context that I was working under, and I think that it worked for me for quite a while, and it still works for me in that sense.
Donna, we've just got you for another few seconds. Do you still hum these in the shower? Do they ever come up? If that's not too personal.
Say that again?
Do you still hum these tunes in the shower?
Oh, sometimes I warm up to them, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's amazing. And do you feel nostalgia for the time, or, you know, that was then, glad to move on?
Well, I feel, yeah, I guess nostalgic in that I don't miss the past in that context, but
mm-hmm.
I remember it with joy, And I think of the pleasures that happened in that time, and I think that it was a growing curve, and I think we're in a different place in the world, but I'm hopeful for the future, you know, and I think that all set the table for where we're headed. And I'm hopeful to be part of whatever the future is, and I hope that I can find the right steps.
We hope so, too. Donna Summer, it's just so great to have you joining us today. 5-time Grammy winner, Donna Summer, Queen of Disco. Her latest album was Crayons. Thank you so much, Donna Summer, for being with us. Just great. Thank you. Alice Eccles, stand by. Listeners, you can join us. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're going deep on disco this hour with an American historian who says it was an era's music of liberation. Fame by David Bowie, 1975, behind us right there. We'll have to ask Alice Eccles about that one. Her new book is Hot Stuff, Disco, and the Remaking of American Culture. You can join us. Were you gay in 1977 and loving it? Did disco set you free? Women, did disco let you shake your booty? Did Donna Summer set you free? African Americans, did disco give you more range? And now is disco back with Lady Gaga and Kesha. We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Alice Eccles, David Bowie, Fame, disco, was this really disco?
Yeah, it's written about as disco. If you go back into the music press of the time, it was seen as disco.
Okay.
It's just that, you see, this was before disco became disco, right? And so early disco was much more sonically varied and, you know, included music that to our ears perhaps sounds more funky. And indeed, he was working with people who had worked with James Brown on that cut. You know, one of the interesting things about disco is that it's so often painted as though and depicted as though it was the complete opposite of rock music. And certainly, it's true that there was a lot of bad blood between disco and rock, especially, you know, when we get to 1978, 79.
Mm-hmm.
But what, you know, there's a kind of hidden story here, a kind of forgotten story, and it's, I think, about the enthusiasm that some rockers, particularly in Britain, people like David Bowie, had for the music that would come to be known as disco. I mean, you know, Bowie was somebody who, right in the middle of his tour, decided to, this was in the summer of 74, ditch the glam rock for the new R&B that was coming out of Philadelphia, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he was looking for a very funky, disco-ish sound. And in fact, fame actually came about one day in the studio when he was, you know, he was there with John Lennon, and John Lennon was tinkering with the guitar line from Shirley and Company's disco song, which was quite a big hit, Shame, Shame, Shame. Lennon slowed it down, and that became the basis for Fame. But in fact, you know, there were a lot of, I mean, the very interesting thing to me about this is that there's this moment around 72, 73, 74, when you find rockers and soul musicians working transatlantically, Jeff Beck and Eric Clapton working with Stevie Wonder, and it seemed, you know, Chaka Khan and Rufus really trying to make music that was not just R&B, but that crossed those boundaries. I would say that even though Donna Summer was not able in her own career to do that for reasons that had to do with the people she was working with, she was really a rocker at heart. And you really hear that with Hot Stuff. And so there was this moment in the early days of disco, this included the Rolling Stones with Hot Stuff, right, where there were all of these musicians, both black and white, and working transatlantically that were interested in breaking down those very narrow genre.
Things might have gone another way.
Conventions. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Absolutely.
Instead, you got women, in a way, picking up on David Bowie. I mean, Madonna coming along behind him, maybe Lady Gaga now. I mean, you can see a lot of David Bowie at work in their acts.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Madonna has and both Madonna and Lady Gaga have talked about the extent to which David Bowie was an inspiration. Gaga, in particular, is such a conceptual artist. But I think one of the things that to me is so interesting about disco's strange history is that at the time, of course, it was completely dismissed as the kind of oral equivalent of fast food. And indeed, this was a metaphor that was used time and again. Mm-hmm. And yet today, for so many experimental artists, which is what I think Gaga is, and, you know, she's hardly the only one, but for sort of avant-pop musicians, disco has now become the kind of taproot of some sort of authentic transgressiveness. So it's very interesting.
We'll come back and look at some of the, maybe a comparison there, but we have so many callers waiting. New Haven, Connecticut, okay. And Claire, you're on the air with Alice Eccles, Claire.
Hello, Tom. And Alice, I want to say I'm a big fan of your work. And,
oh, thank you.
particularly your first book on radical feminism. And I was wondering, you know, back in the 70s when I was hanging out in lesbian bars by night and going to lesbian feminist political meetings by day, there was sort of a big split between what we did to have fun and get girlfriends and what we did as politics. And I'm wondering, was there any pushback from lesbian feminists about the sort of male-oriented qualities of disco?
From the political front. What do you say, Alice? And thanks, Claire.
Well, I mean, listen, certainly when I was DJing in Ann Arbor and I was playing, let's say, George Clinton or Bootsy or Cameo, some of the funkier stuff that tended to foreground, shall we say, female desire a little bit less, I would certainly hear from some women in the crowd who, you know, wanted inexplicably to me to hear Holly Near and women's music. So I did experience a little pushback there. But I think that even lesbian feminists, even the most hardcore feminists, in that era, appreciated the kind of music that Donna Summer and LaBelle and Chaka Khan were making, because this was music that, you know, really was itself pushing back against a tradition in rock music that had really foregrounded male desire and had pushed female desire aside. And so even, I mean, my literary agent was telling me that she certainly had heard stories of even Andrea Dworkin going disco dancing.
All right. Cutting loose. That's great. Claire, thanks for your call. There's an image we'll hang
yes,
out to.
Yes, isn't it?
Here's a Facebook comment from Rachel. She says, I still remember walking 3+ miles with my best friend to our local record stores in the fall of 1977 to buy Saturday Night Fever. Growing up in California, roller disco was in full swing, and gay clubs in the Castro and nearby San Francisco were flourishing. Rachel writes, I still love disco despite my husband's chagrin and love the freedom it gave to so many gays, African Americans, women. Pam in Monticello, hello, Kentucky. You're on the air, Pam.
Hello. What a wonderful program. And I wanted to ask if there were maybe two different kinds of discos, because I remember, of course, the fabulous Donna Summer, Village People. I could go on and on. And the woman, I can't remember her name, who sang Walk Out the Door, I Don't Care Anymore.
Oh, Gloria Gaynor.
Oh, Gloria Gaynor. But then there was a whole other set of disco that I thought was totally mind-numbing. And actually was not really good music. And, in fact, I'm wondering if that didn't partly lead to techno rock, which I do not get at all.
Oh, yeah, good question. I mean, I think, I mean, myself, there was an awful lot of disco music that I couldn't stand. I mean, so I would certainly agree with you. I mean, I think that, you know, yes, there was a lot of bad disco that was produced, and especially once it became so faddish. And even, you know, the musicians and the people who were involved at one of the leading disco labels, Sal Soul, have said that they were just sort of churning this product out. And so that certainly contributed to it. There's no doubt about that. And I think the other thing that is interesting is that really, as the dance floor and the kind of imperative of the dance floor began to take over, it could have the effect, and it sometimes did have the effect, of deprioritizing the desires of the vocalists. And so very, very often, I mean, the emphasis was so
just
much upon the rhythmic.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
And it didn't really matter who was singing it. So, yeah, I mean, I think You know, you don't have to search very, very long and hard for bad disco records.
Of course, just the beat, and you're into techno, which mm-hmm. which clearly a lot of people love as well. Mike in Brattleboro, Vermont. Mike, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. This is great. We danced to disco all night long in Saudi Arabia, and
wow.
we had no trouble with nationalities. We had Lebanese, Saudis, Norwegians, Brits, Americans, and we dressed to the hilt, and we were skinny. We were so thin, and it was super good, and I sure hope they bring it back. I'm 69, and I can't wait till I go out again.
You're ready to go. I love that, Mike, and skinny, no kidding. Look at John Travolta now and then. Man, was he skinny in Saturday Night Fever. Thank you
but
so
you
much.
Wanna know,
yeah.
But you know, a funny story about that is that the original director who was not kept on initially really objected to Travolta and the fact that he felt he couldn't dance, can you believe this, and that he was too fat, can you believe that?
Well, you write that the whole go to the gym and work out thing partly happened because, you know, you go to the disco, a lot of people were taking their shirts off, and then pretty soon you've got to be the buff one.
Absolutely. I mean, that's exactly what happened in New York discos. I mean, and it was gay men who really pioneered the Nautilus.
And off we go to the Nautilus machine. Tom in Norfolk, Virginia. You're on the air, Tom.
Yeah. Hi, Tom and Alice. It's a great show.
Hi.
Alice, I was one of the guys dancing to your music at the Rubaiyat in Ann Arbor.
Whoa.
Is that true?
And I'm now 50 years of age with a little gray in my hair, but I don't think at the time I thought about it, but I think it definitely gave me confidence to kind of face the world, go on in my career, you know, because you'd go out there and get on the dance floor, and you just had a hell of a lot of fun, but also I think if you've got the courage to do that, you realize you can face a lot of other things.
Tom, were you doing that as a straight man or a gay man or what then?
Well, I think just as a man, frankly, because I would go to straight clubs and dance, and the great thing there was I'd dance with women and all these, you know, jock guys that I went to school with,
mm-hmm.
you know, they weren't going to get out on the dance floor, but I could pick up all the chicks because I could go out on the dance floor. And it gave you this kind of confidence, like, hey, I could take this on, you know. Then as far as the gay clubs, that was just fun, and, you know, obviously there was probably another motive there as well, but... but I remember a lot of times at the Rubaiyat, and then the Tangerine Ballroom, do you remember that?
Oh, yes, I do.
Yes.
It's an Ann Arbor reunion right here around disco. Tom, thank you very much for your call. I want to do a little comparison here. This is Thelma Houston, 1976. We'll listen to her and then a little very much more recent Lady Gaga, but this is Thelma Houston with Don't Leave Me This Way. Plenty of dance to that in 1976, Thelma Houston with Don't Leave Me This Way. Fast forward, 2009, Lady Gaga, Bad Romance. Lady Gaga, different sound, but definitely part of the inheritance there. And you can hear it, Alice. I mean, it's, you know, the papers in London all say it's back.
Oh, yeah, it's back. And there was a very good column in the past year by Sasha Ferry Jones in The New Yorker about rap. And even in the world of rap, I mean, the move is definitely towards the dance floor. Disco, I think, for whatever reasons, and I think some of this has to do with the way in which technology has changed music, and especially the internet. We have such access today. And so there's a kind of move, I think, away from purity and towards hybridity, which I think disco was, you know, certainly in its early days, always about. It's like Donna said, it's about sort of, you know, her sort of effort to fool people and to cross boundaries.
Mm.
I mean, that was very much an impulse of disco. I mean, you think about gay people crossing the boundaries into the mainstream, black Americans doing the same, and women as well. I mean, really, it's about music. I mean, she put it very nicely, who cross boundaries.
Women with their desire on board to get right up to speed here. This is called November Mix. This is from Horse Meat Disco. The disco revival is in full swing in the UK. You've heard several references to it here. We see it all over the papers there. Horse Meat Disco is a DJ collective that spins at one of London's most popular gay nightclubs. Here's what you might hear. Any night of the week, Horse Meat Disco. Okay, Alice, I mean, if that's 2009, it could be 1979. Horse Meat Disco November Mix. I feel like I'm having a total flashback here. And off
absolutely.
It goes.
I mean, I have to admit, I don't really know that Works group. You know, I'm not familiar with that group, but it sounds to me like there might be a hint of irony in it.
Well, it has to be. It's contemporary. What shut disco down? Was it AIDS? Was it another musical movement? Was it the Disco Sucks t-shirts that the rock and roll DJs put out?
Well, I do think the fact that it became cross-generational as opposed to simply, you know, youth music was absolutely critical in killing it. I also think that there
you
was
mean the
really
sort of chubby parents dancing at the
yeah,
wedding reception.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody, I mean, you know, once that happens, no music can have any kind of currency or cachet. It's just over. And, you know, we talked earlier about the fact that there was a glut of bad disco music that was on the market. I think also, you know, when you really listen to what somebody like the big discophobe DJ Steve Dahl says about disco and what really bothered him about disco, it was curiously, it seems to have come down to the fact that gay men were making it a lot harder for straight men because now you had to tuck in your shirt and, my God, you had to go to a disco and you had to, like, dance. And so I think that for a lot of rockers, and there really was, mm-hmm. by 1978, 79, 80, you know, there was really extreme anti-disco sentiment out there. There was a sense that, really, you know, disco was screwing things up for us, right? Exactly. And you were having to meet standards set by gay men who didn't even want women.
Of course, it's never, ever really gone away.
No.
Alice Eccles' new book is Hot Stuff, Disco and the Remaking of American Culture. Alice, it's been just great talking with you this hour. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's really been a thrill.
You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Here's Gloria Gaynor, Never Can Say Goodbye, 1974. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thanks for joining us.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.